This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Homes.com knows having the right agent can make or break your home search. That's why they provide home shoppers with an agent directory that gives you a detailed look at each agent's experience, like the number of closed sales in a specific neighborhood, average price range, and more. It lets you easily connect with all the agents in the area you're searching, so you can find the right agent with the right experience and ultimately the right home for you. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Hi, everyone. I'm Katie Couric, and this is Next Question. I love origin stories. The way our lives begin shapes so much about how they play out and how we see the world and the world sees us. My guest today, Jay Shetty, has an origin story that in some ways seems predestined. Business student meets monk. Leaves business to become a monk. Monk finds social media and becomes a spiritual teacher to the world. It almost sounds like a movie, right? But as you'll hear in our conversation, the waters of Jay Shetty run deep. He rejects the term guru, but it's clear he's becoming a guiding light of sorts to many. His enterprise is vast, spanning podcasts. His is called On Purpose to a life coaching training company. Now, some of you may have seen that Shetty's reception hasn't been universally warm. There was a Guardian piece about a month back before Jay and I spoke that scrutinized aspects of his business and his story. His reps then responded, refuting parts of the article they say are untrue. Now, we're not going to litigate the back and forth of it here, but what is irrefutable is Jay Shetty has struck a chord and is providing millions of listeners with advice and observations they seem hungry for. Jay, I'm so happy to be with you.
Oh, I'm happy to be with you. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
You know, I was reading about you, Jay. I know about you already, but to refresh my memory and to learn new things, I was doing some research and I've decided the Dos Equis man has nothing on you. You are the most interesting man in the world, Jay Shetty.
I'm not sure about that, but I take that as a wonderful compliment from you.
It is. I mean, you have had such a rich, diverse life. And I wanted to kind of go back to the beginning because I love to discuss people's origin stories because I feel like we're shaped so much by mm-hmm. our childhoods and our parents. And you grew up in London in a very middle-class family. I know you were bullied in school. How would you describe your childhood in general?
You know, what's really interesting, Katie, is that your own childhood is so normal to you that the word that comes to mind immediately is normal. But that doesn't mean a lot because we all look at everything through our own lenses normal. And if I had to define it or describe it, I'd consider myself to be quite a obedient son. I was someone who worked hard at school. I was always kind to my fellow classmates. My childhood was normal in that sense, but as you mentioned, I was bullied a lot for being overweight. I was bullied for the color of my skin.
Your parents immigrated from India too?
So my mother was born and raised in Yemen.
Oh.
And she moved to London when she was 16 years old because Yemen got its independence and she wanted to keep her British passport. So then she moved over to London. And my dad moved to London from India when he married my mom. And so there was it was really interesting because I grew up in an area where there weren't a lot of people who were Indian. And so even at my school. And so it was quite strange for people to see me. And so What's really fascinating, though, is that even though I'm saying that and I recognize I was bullied, when I actually think about my childhood, I kind of think of it as very normal. It was just, you know, I was going to school. I was trying to work hard. I was trying to be a good son. I was trying to be nice to people. And I look back on it, not looking at it as having any deeply amazing fond memories or having any major negative memories.
It sounds like it was a comfortably middle-class upbringing. I guess your mom was a financial advisor. Your dad was an accountant.
Yes.
You must be good with numbers.
Oh, I'm okay. I don't think my dad was very happy with my math skill when I was growing up. So he'd be pretty angry at me at my poor math grades.
But what did set you apart, Jay, which you were just describing, is kind of the immigrant experience. And I'm curious how that might have shaped you feeling in some ways othered by a lot of your classmates, a lot of your neighbors, a lot of people in your community.
Mm-hmm.
How did that impact you?
So I think that's what's really fascinating. My parents never really let me feel othered. So they never really talk about how we were different or how they were treated. And I think that actually helped me integrate in that I never felt I had a weakness because of the color of my skin, or I didn't feel I had a weakness because of my shape or size at the time or whatever it may be. I never felt weak. I always felt like I fit in, and I always felt like I was doing the right thing, and I always felt like I was a hard worker. So I almost had this sense of, if anyone's being mean to me, it was because of them. And it wasn't really about me at all, because I felt like I was making friends with some people. I was, you know, learning from my teachers. I was getting along with my parents and my family. And so I actually went the other way, where I never actually felt othered. I felt very confident and comfortable with who I was.
And do you think that was because of your parents?
I think it was. I think one thing I've learned over time, and I'm sure you've come across this, is all the studies show that the deep love from one parent can almost act as a shield from so much pain that we go through. And I feel like the depth to which my mother has loved me my whole life has acted as this incredible shield even today, where I feel so protected. And I believe it's because when your parents love you that deeply, you don't ever question whether you're lovable or not. And then when someone doesn't love you, it's so abnormal that you recognize that you have a loving place to go home to. And so I would say it's my mother's love that's acted as such a shield and such a potent force of, often I feel like I have so much love that can overflow to other people because I've been given so much love. So I don't necessarily often seek it either or need it as much, because I feel it's almost overflowing because of the cascading love my mother gave me.
I was going to say you feel filled up already.
Feel very filled, yeah.
What about your dad? Did you feel that from him as well?
No, my dad was totally the opposite. So my dad
kind
was
of withholding?
He was aloof. He was busy. He was, you know, at work, or he was, you know, trying to provide, or he was also, and my mom was the breadwinner for a lot of my life too. So she was doing a lot. But my father was more aloof. And I, again, look at that as something I'm very grateful for. And I don't mean this now. I mean this throughout my whole life, not based on reflection, because it allowed me to become my own man. I never had a man that I had to grow up into being, because I didn't have a role model, and my dad eventually became a friend more than a father. And I'm very grateful for that, because I was allowed to mold myself into the human I wanted to be, and I didn't feel any pressure or expectation from my dad to become a certain type of man. And I look at that freedom as a beautiful gift, because I feel like I got to find my own male role models, which naturally later on in my journey became monks that I studied with. And I feel that's who I accepted as fatherly figures almost in my journey.
I want to talk to you about being a monk, but first I want to just mention how I feel the same way, but luckily from both my parents, how much unconditional love I felt my entire life, and how sad I am when other people didn't get that from their parents. I feel so fortunate. And, you know, looking back on my childhood and my life until the moment when my parents passed away, I don't think it even dawned on me to question their love for me. Mm-hmm. It was so deep and constant. And I just feel so lucky, because I think it does – give you a certain sense of protection when you're out in the world. I recently interviewed Kamala Harris, and I thought it was so interesting that she said she never felt, I read this because we didn't talk about it. We were too busy talking about Israel, immigration, and abortion. But she said, I never felt that I didn't belong anywhere.
Yeah, same.
You know, and she must have had that also, that fierce, unconditional love that made her feel strong enough to almost be in any environment. And that's such a gift, isn't it?
It really is. And I'm the same as you. I feel a deep sense of empathy and compassion for those that didn't receive that and can completely understand as to why it leads to so many challenges in the future, because you don't have that deep well to pull from and your foundation is not built on that deep sense of love, belonging, connectedness. And so it's been really interesting. And having both my parents, one, like I said, being more aloof and one being very present, it's also interesting to me as to how all of that can affect us. But how much of it is, you know, something that I've often found is that all of us have to reparent ourselves or parent ourselves later on. And that journey is something that I see so many people beautifully, gracefully coming towards of learning to reparent themselves, learning to heal themselves. And it's something that's necessary for everyone, even if you were loved. Because what's really fascinating is, I call it in my second book, Eight Rules of Love, the gifts and gaps that our parents give us. And so if our parents leave gaps in how we're raised, we often try and fill them through other people. But if our parents give us gifts of love and greatness in their parenting, we often also still look for other people to repeat those things.
Right.
And that can be a painful process.
Yeah.
Because no one will love us as deeply as our parents loved us.
And sometimes I think it's hard for us to accept people who don't love us, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's confusing and hard to understand.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a thing of loving too much in some cases.
Absolutely.
Right?
That's what I mean. That's exactly it. That a gift can be a gap and a gap can be a gift. It's very dependent on how we have perceived it and how we've processed it.
Let's talk about your years as a monk, 3 years in all. You were in business school and you had somebody come and talk to you all. Who was that again?
It was a monk.
Called
Gaurangadas, yeah.
And you thought, hey, that sounds like a good life, like, you know, the life of a monk. Wait, what? I'm curious, like, what appealed to you about that?
Yeah, I was at a point in my life, and I still have this today, I think it's why I do my podcast and why I interview people. I think I fell in love with studying and observing humans in my teens. And so I was reading everything from Martin Luther King to Malcolm X, David Beckham to Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Like, I was reading autobiographies and biographies. And even till this day, biopics are my favorite type of movies, whether it's Bohemian Rhapsody about Queen or whether it's Oppenheimer this year. Like, I love movies.
Learning about people.
I love learning about fascinating people.
I'll have to give you my memoir.
Absolutely. I would love to read it. And to me, that's kind of how I've always been. And then my friends invited me to hear a monk speak. And I didn't really know too much about monks. So I wasn't feeling inspired or excited because this wasn't someone I knew of and not someone I recognized. But my friends were very persuasive. And they said to me, you know, let's just go along to this event. And I said, well, as long as we go to a bar afterwards, then I'll come along. So I went along to this event, not expecting anything. And what really impressed me was, here was a man with an Indian accent, wearing robes, and of Indian descent, sitting and talking so comfortably in a college room in London with no anxiety, no nerves, no qualms, no feeling of like he didn't belong. And I saw someone who was so confident in their own skin. And now upon reflection, I always realized that I think at that point in my life, I'd met or seen people who were rich and famous and beautiful and powerful and strong. But I don't think I'd ever met anyone who was truly happy or content as they were, and he was. And there was something inside of me that just said, I want that. Like, that's what I want to feel. That's what I want to experience. That seems like a worthy pursuit. And often people will say, well, did you have something in you? Or, you know, how did you have that sense at 18? And I would say, I don't think the credit goes to me. I think the credit goes to him. And I still know him today. He's a dear friend and mentor in my life. And he still carries that presence. When anyone meets him, he has this magnetic energy because of his deep spiritual practice that can take away all types of barriers. And so for me, the credit goes to his presence and his aura far more than my qualification at the time, which I don't think I had much of.
So you're studying business, then you decide I'm going to move to India, right?
So not immediately. I spent the next, because I was at college, I spent the next summers and Christmases visiting him in India. And I was also interning at corporate companies in London. And then when I graduated, that's when I made the decision that I would prefer to live as a monk than in the corporate world, which were my two choices pretty much. And I felt so much more drawn to a life of mental mastery and service as opposed to a life of getting a job in the traditional sense. And so I traded my suits for robes and went off to live as a monk across India and the UK and Europe for 3 years. We would travel as well, often encouraged to come back to the UK to serve where we were from and connect with people. And it was truly one of the most beautiful experiences of my life that I cherish so deeply. And I was just at the monastery last week. I was in India visiting again. I go back every year to reconnect and reground myself.
So obviously it was incredibly formative, but you ultimately decided that wasn't the life you wanted. Before you tell me why that was the case, I'm curious, what do you do when you're a monk? What is a day in the life of a monk like?
So you wake up at 4 a.m.
Okay, I'm out on that. I did that for too many years.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. I can imagine you did. So you wake up at 4 a.m. There's collective meditation and prayers from 4:30 till about 5:30. And then there are a couple of hours or 2 hours of personal meditation. Then there's more collective meditation. Then there's more private meditation.
Jeez, and that's a lot of meditation.
That takes you all the way up to breakfast. And there's a wisdom class. And then the rest of the day looks different. It can be a mix of chores, more meditation, philanthropic work, service work, going out and serving, especially in India, serving villagers, serving the homeless, interacting. So there's a lot of service work as well. And that's the path, that's why I chose the path that I did, because half of it was in silence and for the self, and the other half of it was service. And I felt that that felt like a balance that made sense to my, you know, Western ideology as well, of I wanted to actually do something as well. I didn't just want to be. And so that balance was of being and doing that seemed to work very well.
And ultimately, why did you decide that this was not the life you wanted to choose?
Well, I think what's really interesting is that the goal of the amount of time you spend as a monk, one of the goals is self-awareness. You gain so much insight into how the mind works, into your triggers, your weaknesses, your imperfections, your flaws. And the biggest conclusion I came to was I wasn't a monk, in that my self-awareness showed me that I'm quite independent, I'm quite rebellious, I have a certain way that I like to do things. And that was quite humbling at that time, because you've kind of geared yourself up to do this thing. And, you know, earlier you mentioned that I've had such an interesting or fascinating journey. When I chose to become a monk, it wasn't met with that emotion or experience from my family or extended family. Most people thought I was wasting my life. I was throwing away my education. I was committing career suicide. I was letting my parents down, and I'd probably been brainwashed. And so it wasn't met with this, oh my gosh, this is going to be such an amazing life experience. How beautiful. It was met with cynicism and skepticism.
Well, you can understand why parents were a little like, wait a second, Jay, what?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can. And it's just interesting how something that was initially so seen that way has become something that is so interesting and fascinating.
Well, I also think interest in meditation and this kind of idea of a life of purpose and service and community, I think now, probably much more so when you were even 18, people are craving that. So yes. I think in a way, it's almost more understandable today in the environment we're living in now.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you decided, I'm not going to be a monk anymore. Was your mentor upset, by the way, when you decided to leave the monastery?
It was more the other way around. I was upset with myself. I felt pretty embarrassed. I felt a bit ashamed. I felt a little bit of guilt because I had put all that pressure on myself that I was going to do this for the rest of my life. And so leaving was probably one of the most difficult things I ever had to do. And I'd say my teachers made it easier than they did harder. I got some beautiful advice. I remember talking to my mentor and saying to him that I'm not going to be able to pursue this path anymore. And that I was worried that I wasn't sure if it was the right decision. I was actually quite uncertain about if it was the right move. I was scared that actually I may regress and move backward in my journey that I'd tried to take steps forward in. And he said to me, he said, Jay, you know, when people go to college, some people stay at the college and they become professors and researchers, and some people leave and they get jobs. And he said, which one's better? And I said, well, it doesn't matter. It depends on the person. And he said exactly the same. He said, some people join the monastery and they become monks, and then they stay and they become senior monks, and some people leave and they go off and live their life. And they reminded me that leaving didn't mean I had to leave the philosophy or the tradition or the practice. It was simply leaving an external practice of it. And I think that that was very comforting at a time when I was definitely feeling anxious and confused about what I would do when I went back. Everyone around me would, and they did say, I told you so. We knew you wouldn't make it. Oh, and have you heard about your friend who's now dating that wonderful girl? And have you seen that person who's got promoted now? And oh, did you know so-and-so just moved into that new apartment? And all of a sudden, you're hearing about the great wins and successes and progress that all your friends and family and others have made, and how you've been left behind. And so I came back to a world that was reminding me of potentially how I'd wasted 3 years of my life, as opposed to a celebration of coming back.
After a quick break, how Jay's 3 years as a monk laid the foundation for the life and businesses he's built. If you want to get smarter every morning with a breakdown of the news and fascinating takes on health and wellness and pop culture, sign up for our daily newsletter, Wake Up Call, by going to katiecurric.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Now more of my conversation with Jay Shetty. It seems to me your time as a monk really informed who you are today and set you on a path to be who you wanted to be ultimately. And you are living a life of service your podcast and your books. And you've created kind of this space for yourself that I don't think you would have. Not that I know everything about you, Jay Shetty, but you wouldn't have done it if you had not had those 3 years of experience. Mm-hmm. And can you just explain how you got from failing monk school, I'm kidding, from deciding you weren't going to be a monk, to creating, honestly, And I don't even want to call it a business because I feel like that demeans it in a way. But how did you get from there to here?
Yeah. And I want to change that too. I think I empathize with what you're saying there, but it would be nice to redeem the word business too. You know, I think sometimes the word business gets a bad rap, but I almost feel
and
that.
Maybe enterprise is, sounds a little less, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, but the journey was, at least at the time, felt slow and confusing, and now looking back feels perfectly aligned. And I'm always remembering that beautiful quote from Steve Jobs where he said that you can't connect the dots looking forwards, you only can looking backwards. And when I look back at that time, I first thought I just need to pay my bills because I was living with my parents again. And, you know, I couldn't just depend on them for the rest of my life. So I wanted to find a way. And I thought I'd have to go back into a job that made sense. So I was applying to consulting firms because that felt like where I would have ended up previously. I was rejected from 40 companies before even an interview. No one would even get me an interview through the door because, surprise, surprise, no one wants to hire a former monk on their resume. Like, people are like, well, what are your transferable skills? Being silent and sitting still, we don't need that in our company. So I wouldn't get an interview. And I was getting really, really anxious that, okay, I may have made the worst decision because how am I going to survive in the real world now? And then finally, I got a job at Accenture, which I'm extremely grateful for. If they didn't give me a shot, I don't know who would have. And they put me on their grad program. I was age 25 and everyone else was age 21, but I took it. I was happy to work my way up and figure it out. And so I spent 2 years there.
And what was your job there, Jay?
My job there, I joined as an analyst and then graduated on to become a consultant. I worked on everything at the time from digital strategy to social media. That was the growing, rising tide in the world in 2013, especially in that B2B space or the business space. And I was actually gaining confidence because Accenture prioritized mental health inside the organization in a really phenomenal way.
I was going to say they were very early.
Absolutely. Early adopters and really valuing trying to help people and, you know, figure it out. And when they discovered that I had learned meditation and about my background, they encouraged me to do that in the workplace. So I would lead meditations in rooms probably the size of this.
Maybe, it's a very small room for you all who can't see it.
Maybe two people would show up and I would be so excited to share meditation with two people. And I would keep doing that. And every week, more and more people would come. Different parts of the company would invite me. I would travel around the company to teach meditation and mindfulness. And then once I was asked to teach my entire cohort, my colleagues of 1,000 people at our summer event. And I was an employee inside the company. I didn't have a brand or I didn't have a business or a website or anything or at all. I was an employee. And that gave me so much confidence that what I had learned had so much value in the real world because people would come up to me and talk to me about how the sessions had helped them and helped them get through a really tough time or overcome burnout. And I was receiving all this positive feedback from my colleagues. And I thought to myself, well, maybe this should reach more people. Like, how beautiful would it be if this would connect with more people? And I'd been then doing an event in the city of London. I would invite whoever would come. And teaching and sharing has always been a part of my fascination. I did this even at college. Ever since I met the monk, I was giving small seminars and lectures about everything he'd teach me to my fellow students at university. And so I thought to myself, I want this to reach more people. And so I created a plan to pitch my video series idea to media companies in London. Applied to 10 of them. They all turned me down. And then I networked with 3 executives and I asked them to give me a break. And I said, I don't care what you pay me. I will do this for free. I just want to create these videos and this series. And maybe it's a show, whatever it is. And I got 3 answers. You're too old. I was 28 years old. You're too late and you're too unqualified. And I didn't have a communications background or I didn't have a degree in it. So people thought I didn't have the skills. And so I was feeling like, oh, well, here we are again. Like, this isn't going anywhere. How is this going to build? And I ended up at a ethnic minority TV presenter workshop in London. So again, it was a room probably triple the size of this room, 5 to 6 brown people and black people in this room being trained in presenting. I went there to see if I could develop the skills. And when I went there, they said, hey, Jay, you actually have some really good skills. I said, great, give me a job in media. And they said, well, there's no jobs in media. And I said, wow, so you invited 5 to 6 brown and black people here to tell us that there's no jobs in media. Thank you so much.
And this was 11 years ago or so?
This was 2015.
All right, so 9 years ago. Yeah. And think of what they would say today, but go on.
So then they said to me, they said, well, why don't you start a YouTube channel? And I hadn't really considered social media then because I didn't really understand it fully. I didn't know what it could do. I didn't have any case studies or examples in that way. And I said to them, I said, well, that works for Justin Bieber. Like, that's not going to work for me. And I got to a point, and I'm reminded of this quote often, and I still live by it today. Thomas Edison said that when you believe you've exhausted all options, remember this, you haven't. And I live by that today. Whenever I feel I've knocked on every door, I realize there's still one more way through. When I feel like I've broken through every door, I feel like you have to realize you might have to jump over a wall. Like, when I feel like I've pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and I'm running out of energy, I know that I need to push once more. And so I started a YouTube channel because I didn't have another choice. So I didn't come into social media ever thinking social media would be the way I would connect with people. I came to social media because I didn't know what else to do to connect with people. And so I made my first video in 2016, got like 100 views, and I was over the moon. I was so happy. And as I continued to make those videos, my boss at Accenture, well, not even my boss, our global HR leader saw them on the intranet, the internal social media and website. And she showed it to Arianna Huffington at Davos. And Arianna Huffington loved the videos. So she sent Danny Shea and Dan Katz, who became two really dear friends, who were her core people at the time, I think still are now, sent them over to meet me in London. And they said, and I went there ready to ask Danny for a job. So I said, Danny, you've got to give me a job. I want to do this for the rest of my life. I'll do it for free. I don't care. I'm here to work. And he said to me, he said, slow down. He said, we're going to share your videos on the Huffington Post page. And depending on how they do, we'll see how this goes. They put out the first video. The first video did 1 million views in 7 days.
Oh,
and
my
I was over the moon. I was just like, I can't believe this. And they were like, yeah, that's okay for us.
Okay.
Then they put out the second video, and the second video did 1 million views in 24 hours. And they go, okay, there's something happening here. Then we put out the third video. The third video did 1 million views in 16 hours. And then it just went from there. And those four videos we made probably have done around 200 million views across different platforms at the time.
By the way, can I just interject and say, God bless Arianna Huffington, who I love, who is one of the most generous people on the planet. And gosh, I wonder, do you ever think, gee, if Arianna hadn't seen something,
it would have taken so much longer, and maybe it would never have happened as you know, fast as it did happen.
Do you still see Arianna
all the time? Yeah,
I hope you send her flowers every day.
Oh no,
Jay.
she knows how much I love her, and I appreciate her so deeply, and I'm so grateful to her. And I think everyone needs that. Everyone needs someone like that who allows their work and their world to be seen and put out there.
But how wonderful, she saw something in you, right? And I always think it only takes one person to see a spark or something in another person to just give them a chance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you think of how much untapped talent is out there, but they just haven't had someone say, hey, I want to give you this opportunity.
Absolutely.
And I'm so happy she did, because you went from, I guess, those videos on Huffington Post to your podcast, right? I mean, tell me what happened after that, because your trajectory must have been straight up.
Well, it's never that easy. There's always so many pivots to the story. So I'm over the moon that my videos are doing well. And then I messaged and emailed Danny Shea every day for 30 days and begged him for a job. I said, come on, these stats have to prove to you that I should be doing this full time. And I messaged him every day. And I said, Danny, I'm going to message you for the rest of my life until you give me a job.
He just wanted you to stop messaging him.
Yeah, yeah. And so Danny goes, all right. And then Danny and Arianna figured out my visa. I moved to the United States. I moved to New York in 2016. And they gave me a role at the Huffington Post. And the most funny thing happened. The day I landed in New York, my first day was Arianna's last day, because she left to start Thrive. And it was, I was at her leaving party on my arrival day.
That's so funny.
And it was, so I was there for 6 months and then I went off in 2017 to build my own world. And it wasn't easy. You know, 2017 was a year of me figuring out how to do this and how it would land and what we would build. And content was in its early stages and, you know, it wasn't
disintermediation.
Yeah, you couldn't monetize it immediately. You're spending money creating content. It was a really interesting year. And I really, really wanted to do more long form content. I was making these 4 minute videos, and these videos at the time were doing 200, 300, 100 million views a video. But I really felt that I had more to share and more stories to tell, and there was more to understand.
And also more people you wanted to talk to, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Kind of going back to your monk days.
To study people, yeah. To study people. And so I ended up pitching again to another bunch of podcast networks my podcast idea, and the feedback I got was, we're not interested, or, Jay, people like listening to you for 4 minutes. No one wants to listen to you for an hour. And I had a company that pulled out.
Boy, were they wrong.
I had a company that pulled out 2 weeks before we launched on purpose because they felt it wasn't going to be a big podcast, in those words.
Do you ever call those people and say, nah.
Not at all.
Or am I just the only petty one?
No, I'll tell you why. And I'll tell you why. So that thought has crossed my mind. I would be lying if that thought hadn't crossed my mind. The thought has crossed my mind, but I'll tell you why. They did me the biggest favor in the world because I own my work. Whole, like, through and through, we own everything we've ever created. They gave me the biggest blessing of my life. We didn't sign any bad contracts. We didn't sign any bad deals. At that point, I would have written half my life away for an opportunity, but we didn't. And so I'm extremely grateful to everyone who said no, because it meant that we built our own platform from scratch with our own investment and our own hard work.
So now you've written 2 New York Times bestsellers. You have your podcast, which is enormously popular, called On Purpose, which is very clever because purpose is your bag. And I'm curious, as somebody who I consider myself a pretty good communicator, and I'd love to learn from you what you think makes your podcast so effective and how I could do better.
I mean, I'm sure I can't give you any tips. That's very humble of you.
No, I think you could, actually. And I think part of a really important aspect of life, and you must agree with this, is to always want to learn and grow.
Absolutely.
And never feel like you can improve or get better at something.
Yeah.
So I say this with not false modesty, but with genuine curiosity. Tell me a little bit about your approach with guests.
Yeah, well, I think everyone creates a different atmosphere. I'm communicating differently today because of the energy you've created. So I'm far more subdued today. My tone is far more calm and still and peaceful than it often is.
Am I overwhelming you, Jay?
No, not at all. It's because you've created a really still environment in this room, and I can sense that, and therefore I'm responding to that in a positive way. And it's bringing out a type of communication in me that requires this type of stillness to come out. And that's something you've crafted and created. And
you mean
you
from
carry.
Our physical surroundings?
Not even the physical surroundings, because I think the way you talk and the pace at which you talk informs me as to how this conversation is flowing. I was on a podcast earlier today and we were talking really fast, and I was talking really fast, and it was really animated. I was using my hands and my tone's going up and down. Whereas today I'm with you, I'm not there, and that it's not a good or bad thing. I think the beauty of podcasting, or the beauty of any interview format, is the interviewer gets to guide the tone and the pace and the quality of the conversation. And I think whether you talk fast or slow, it's not about the pace. It's that both are creating the environment right for the community and the audience. And so for me, with my podcast, my goal was always to create a deep, safe space for raw vulnerability, and for people to share things that they were uncomfortable with.
And they do.
And they
like
do.
Like Tom Holland shared something very personal about his drinking.
Yes, yeah, his sobriety journey, which was, you know, really beautiful of him to share. I know so many people messaged me after that podcast and told him too, saying just how much that's helped them in their journey. And that was my goal. My goal was, I wanted people that you recognized to share a part of themselves that you'd never seen. Or I wanted people you didn't recognize to share insights that you'd never heard. And my hope was that the audience in our community would feel so seen, heard, and understood, because the guest felt seen, heard, and understood. And that would translate to the people at home. And so my podcast was not mental or technical or theoretical or philosophical. It was deeply emotional and inside our hearts. And that was my goal, was to lead a podcast from the heart, not the mind.
You've had so many well-known people. I'm curious, who has surprised you in that environment? Who has been very different than you thought they would be?
I'd say everyone's been different in the way I thought they'd be, because everyone has so much more depth. And I think of that with humanity in general. I feel everyone has a story. Everyone has so much more depth than we uncover. One person that comes to mind immediately is Brian Chesky,
the founder of Airbnb.
I love Brian too. I absolutely adore him.
He started Airbnb for
everyone. Yeah, the founder
who's
of
listening.
Airbnb. Yeah. Brian Chesky, one of the founders of Airbnb. He founded it with his two friends. And he came on the show. And what I love about him is that he's just not a tech founder. He's an artist. He's a design thinker.
Right.
And what I loved about that episode with him is, after the interview, he told me he's so used to being asked, what does it feel like to IPO or build a, mega billion-dollar company? And we didn't talk about that. And that's always my goal. My goal is to ask you the question that you never get asked, because people may not want you to go that deep, or they may not think you're able to go that deep. But I believe everyone is able to go that deep. And you'll see, if anyone watches it or listens to the episode, you see Brian almost walking us through the visions of what he's building in a company in his mind. And it turns into somewhat of a collaborative visualization session as opposed to an interview. And it was just a beautiful experience. And we both walked away becoming really good friends off of it, and it just created a beautiful relationship. So I think people like that surprised me in a positive sense. I knew he could go there, but surprised me in the sense of he was so willing to go there and so vulnerable to share his own journey.
You officiated Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez's wedding.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah, it was a really fun experience.
How did that happen, Jay?
Jennifer Lopez came on the podcast in 2020, at the beginning of 2020, and that's when we first connected. And we really got along, we hit it off, and then we stayed in touch and we were connected. And then she invited me to officiate weddings at the launch of her Marry Me musical performance. So there were people from her community that her and Maluma were the witnesses, and I was officiating the weddings. We stayed connected, had lots of conversations. And then when I was asked to do this, I mean, I was getting invited to someone's wedding is pretty spectacular, let alone having to officiate. And I was the most nervous, anxious, and, anxious wreck that I'd ever been, because I was like, wow, like this is a lot of pressure, and it's pretty hard to do something like this. But we had a really beautiful chat to really understand the type of ceremony they wanted. And then on the day, it was just one of the most surreal experiences of my life, because I love love. I love everything to do with romance. And I'm having the experience of like, am I in a movie or am I in reality? Because I've only ever seen weddings like this in a movie. And then I'm like, no, this is real. Get back into reality. And then just trying to convince myself to not cry, because I love crying at weddings. Like, I will cry at everyone's wedding because I love love. And so the whole time, while Ben's standing right next to me and he's shedding a tear and Jennifer's walking down the aisle in a dress and everyone's looking at her, and I'm just like, Jay, do not cry. This is not about you. Do not cry. And just holding it together the whole time. But it was really a beautiful experience. I was so grateful for the opportunity, and it will truly always remain as one of the most special memories that I'll cherish for a long, long time.
When we come back, how Jay balances his desire for depth and purpose with a life that's gotten pretty snazzy.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring? but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
We're back with Jay Shetty. I'm curious, since you have become friends with a lot of fancy people and have a lot of well-known folks on your podcast, does that ever come into conflict with sort of your core message? Or has it made people look at you differently? And maybe do you sometimes, because of the fact that you're well-known and celebrity and fame come with a lot of good things, but also some tough things. Has that been hard for you to balance in a way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that all my close friendships in that space have originated from really organic, deep conversations. So any friends that I have in, and I'm assuming what you're referring to is celebrity friends, are all because all of our conversations are based on really deep, thoughtful ideals. And so for me, it's actually one of the greatest joys of my life, because I get to talk about what I care about with people who care about what we're talking about and are trying in their own way to grow, to improve, to learn, to... And it's been one of the greatest joys of my life to get to know people with that much depth, because it requires so much vulnerability and openness from both sides. And so that's been, again, something that I cherish for the rest of my life, and I believe I've made friends for life. I think on the podcast too, for me, like we talked about earlier, I've always been fascinated by studying the lives of incredible journeys and the fact that I get to sit with those people.
And accomplished people who have, you know, unique talents too, right?
Yeah, and accomplished different things in that, you know, we've had Lewis Hamilton, who's, you know, potentially the greatest Formula One racer of all time. And, you know, Lewis is a deep meditator, and he's a deep practitioner of focus, and he's such a disciplined individual. So I also don't think it's extrapolating how did you become successful. It's almost like, how did you become present, and how did you become focused? And these are all skills that we all need. So to me, I'm extrapolating more than...
And how did you not get screwed up by your success, right?
Exactly, exactly. Like, how have these people, like Lewis is a wonderful human, and that's what I'm intrigued by, is how someone maintains their ego in that space. And so even the lessons we're extrapolating, kind of going back to the Brian Chesky point, I'm not really interested in asking him, hey, how did you become worth X billion dollars? Like, that's really not, I don't really care about that. I don't ask questions like that on the show. All the questions are about humanity and mindset and well-being. And then, of course, it is challenging. I think that it's natural when people see you interacting with certain groups or certain people, you know, people have assumptions and judgments, and it's never easy being judged. And I've always said, whenever anyone judges me or you hear any criticism or whatever it may be, what I'd love to do is you'd love to just sit down with each of those people and just spend time with them, like have some tea with them and just talk to them. And if only you could do that with a million people, you'd have to probably see, 100 people every day for the rest of your life, and you probably won't even come close. And so it's really hard. I think that's what I find challenging, not hearing judgment. I respect people's opinions, and I recognize the paradoxical nature externally of what something can look like. I recognize the contradiction externally of what people may see. But to me, I don't judge that. I totally respect that. But I can't do anything about it. And so you almost sit there and allow for it to exist and recognize that you can only continue to do the work that's close to your heart.
I'm curious, you know, I know your most recent book is The 8 Rules of Love, How to Find It, Keep It, and Let It Go. And you previously wrote in 2020, Think Like a Monk, and both books have done very well. Does anyone ever challenge you and say, like, Jay Shetty, you're a great guy, but how the hell do you know about this stuff? And mm-hmm. I guess the question is, how did you accumulate such wisdom? And do you always feel confident in your ability to be what is, in essence, a spiritual teacher?
I think I've tried to live my life in a way to get as far away from that title as possible. And I think partly why I...
The title of spiritual teacher?
Or guru.
You feel like guru is really misunderstood.
Well, I think guru is just a very sacred word in the East. You know, a guru is someone who promises to dedicate their life to uplifting you out of the ocean of material misery. Like, it's a very deep position. It's almost like mother or father or even like godfather or, you know, like that godmother. Like, it has a very weighty responsibility that comes with it. So you can't possibly be a guru for the world, because then you'd have to promise to uplift each and every person. It's almost a vow. And so I respect the word guru a lot, and it comes with a lot of weight for me. But I think that I'm more trying to be everyone's spiritual friend as opposed to a spiritual teacher. And I think that's because I think the challenge is that teachers will always let us down because no one's perfect. And often teachers, in their attempt to try and be perfect or present themselves as perfect, end up letting people down anyway. And so one of the reasons why I enjoy dressing fashionably, why I enjoy living the life I do, is to kind of take that away. And I'd rather be everyone's spiritual friend and not try to be someone else. But in terms of the wisdom, as you were saying about writing the books, and if I feel confident about it, I feel confident about my research and ability to connect ideas more than I do in my teachings. And I think the idea of what I'm trying to do in both my books, so whenever I think like a monk, Think Like a Monk is a deep research study in how monks live. So you'll hear me quote from Christian monks and Buddhist monks and Hindu monks, and you'll hear me share the stories and teachings that have existed for thousands and thousands of years. So my confidence isn't in the fact I lived as a monk for 3 years. My confidence is in the fact that this tradition that has lasted thousands of years must have some serious validity for it to last that long. There's very few things that have lasted 1,000 years, let alone more than that. And the fact that some of these books, texts, and wisdom traditions and practices have been around, I think makes me confident that they have validity, especially when I can draw parallels with modern science. When I wrote the love book, a lot of questions were like, well, what do you know about love? You haven't been married for that long. And I think that, again, if someone reads the book, I'm not teaching from my marriage. The book isn't a book that says, hey, I have a really successful marriage, why don't you learn from me? It's me having spent so much time trying to read and study and learn and interviewed couples and spent time with them who are older than me, far more wiser than me. And my job is to curate, synthesize, and share what, going back to what you were saying, to often communicate ideas that get lost in academic journals and college rooms that people may never learn or hear about. And so I take confidence in the fact that I have a great research method. I trust myself in my ability to synthesize and make things simple, accessible, and practical. But my confidence in the wisdom is because the wisdom exists outside of me and before me.
There's been so much emphasis on self-love. I strongly advocate for self-love. I think it's great. But I wonder, and I'm curious how you feel about this, Jay, Can you place so much emphasis on self-love, self-improvement, self in general, that it precludes you from being of service, from caring about other people, from being attuned to other people's needs, which has shown to be the true way to happiness? You know, I always believe you get what you give. And, you know, being kind to other people is sort of the key to life.
Mm-hmm.
How do you balance those two things? And I, you know, blah, blah, I know you can't love other people if you don't love yourself, yada, yada, yada. But I just, sometimes I feel like there's so much self-focus,
mm-hmm.
it prevents people from looking outside of themselves.
Yeah. I mean, the beautiful lesson that I learned during my time as a monk was that the reason you take care of yourself is to serve others. So therefore, it's symbiotic in that—
Do you feel like it's symbiotic in our current culture?
I would say that because culture generally oscillates between extremes, we often have to go to one extreme and then go to the other to find the middle path. And so maybe we lived in a culture where people were just trying to help other people. I don't even know if we ever lived there, but let's say that we lived there, or at least some people did, like maybe mothers did, right? Let's say that. We can probably agree on that a lot of mothers maybe lived quite a—
And sacrificed.
Sacrificed a lot and sacrificed their life, right? If there was a part of society that we could agree on that with that one, hopefully it's a lot of moms. And so if mothers did that, then sometimes I think we have to oscillate to the other extreme of, okay, just take care of yourself now. And then society evolves to recognize, well, actually, the reason I take care of myself is so that I can extend myself to others. And so I feel that that's kind of how I watch things kind of evolve in society. I don't think things ever evolve in the way you want them to. We kind of do the pendulum swing because we're trying to find the middle. We're trying to get that pendulum to land perfectly, but it doesn't. And we keep going. It's almost like saying, should we hustle or should we meditate? Some people are like, if you want to be successful, you have to hustle. And some people are like, if you want to be successful, you have to meditate to be still. And it's like, well, you actually need to do both. But we kind of oscillate between the extremes. So I think with everything, I think the point is that I'm making is it's the reason you take care of yourself is more important than even taking care of yourself. So I take care of myself and my health and my well-being so that I can do more for others, as opposed to I'm taking care of myself because I'm the most important person in the world and nothing else matters. I think that intention makes us more hard-hearted. And, you know, you don't want to become more hard-hearted, you want to become more soft-hearted. And when we do hard things, we often do just become harder and harder and harder. And the goal is to become softer while you do hard things. Because actually, when you're doing something difficult, the goal is you should become more compassionate because you realize how hard it is for anyone else to do it. And so I think surrender and self-love and service should create a softer heart because you start recognizing how steep a climb it is for you and therefore how steep a climb it is for anyone you're trying to help.
Tell me about your wife. She's a chef?
She's a plant-based, recipe developer, and she has a cookbook coming out. And,
oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, she has her own YouTube channel.
Where did you all meet?
So we tell this story
in full. I love asking people how they met.
We tell this story in full on my first ever podcast on purpose of how I met my wife. And the short version that I'll tell you here is I was in my final year of university and I knew I was going to become a monk. So I would go to my local temple to serve and stay out of trouble. Because as soon as you make a commitment thinking you're going to become a monk, the allures of life become very amplified. And so I was trying to stay out of trouble. And while I was trying to stay out of trouble, I was asked to show a lady around the temple with services and certain chores and certain rituals at the temple. She was around my mom's age. And so I was showing her around. And then afterwards, she said to me, I have a daughter that I'd love to introduce into spirituality. She's around your age. How do I do that? And I said, well, I'm going off to become a monk, but I can introduce her to my sister. And my sister's—
I'm sure, I'm about to go off and be a monk excuse.
Yeah, that was my excuse. And so she brought her daughter and I'd invited my sister so that they could connect. And that happened to be my wife's mom. And she was bringing her daughter to learn more about spirituality. And so I introduced my now wife and my sister. And I went off, became a monk. They became best friends. And so when I came back from the monastery, she was at my house all the time. And so my sister was the person who was our in-between, who was like, she likes you. And then, you know, my liking of her back. But the first time I saw her, I thought she was the most beautiful person I'd ever seen. And if you ask her, she'll say, nah, I didn't feel anything. So it was good that I became a monk then, because I didn't have a shot at that time. So I didn't have a chance.
But how many years have you been married?
We've been together for 11 years and married for 8. And so it's been a lot of fun.
Do you have any children?
Not yet. No, not yet. We've been through so much change together. We got married. We moved to New York. We moved to LA. We both quit our jobs in London. We transitioned. There's been so much change and chaos in our lives in a good way. And I think, you know, we've been lucky to become closer through it. And I think that's been a priority for us. I think if we would have added kids to that, I think it may have hampered our relationship with each other.
Let me ask you a couple questions from my social media followers.
Please.
Gosh, social media has come a long way, hasn't it? Goodness. Does positive self-talk really work?
Great question. So to answer that question, you have to understand that self-talk already exists. And I think people don't think about this. When we hear the word positive self-talk, we're like, does it really work? Well, negative self-talk works. I'm guessing that everyone says in their mind at some point, I don't think I'm good enough. No, I shouldn't do that. I probably won't make it. I probably won't work for me. We are all practicing negative self-talk every day by default, regardless. And it's working because it's making us more miserable. It's making us sad. It's making us not believe in ourselves. I was reading a study the other day that was talking about there's two types of voice in our head. One is, I am lazy. I am not good enough. And the other voice we have in our head says, you're lazy. You're not good enough. And that often is even worse and harder to handle as an inner critic because it sounds like an authority figure in our mind telling us. And often that voice has been picked up from family members, teachers, partners, friends, ex-boyfriends, girlfriends, whatever else it may be. We've adopted someone else's voice as our own. And so positive self-talk isn't saying you're the best, you're amazing, you can do anything you want, right? Like that's not positive self-talk. I don't love the words negative and positive when it comes to self-talk. I like the way of coaching yourself. And what I mean by that is, if you were with a coach who is trying to help you become better and improve, how would they talk to you? People often say, talk to yourself as if you talk to your friend. And I think people struggle with that. But talk to yourself the way you believe a good coach would talk to you to get the most out of you. How would they understand how to challenge you, how to check you, how to encourage you, how to champion you? And so to me, positive self-talk, a healthier version of that, is me saying, for example, if I wake up and go, I'm so tired, right? Positive self-talk would be, I'm so energized. Now that doesn't work because you can't just lie to yourself and your mind's not going to believe it. So the actionable item is, I am tired and I will go to sleep early tonight. It's an acceptance of how you feel with an action of how to make it better. I am not good enough and I can learn how to improve. It's the accepting of how we're feeling right now with an action of how we can be better, of how we can grow. And so that's what I would recommend to anyone who's trying to learn what positive self-talk is.
Or giving yourself grace. I am tired because I went to bed late last night and I should be tired, right? I think this sort of self-flagellation that we sometimes resort to, I don't know. I give myself a lot of grace. I'm really good at that.
Yeah, me too. You have to. I mean, especially if you're living a high-stress life, which I think so much of the population is today, you have to give yourself grace because you're all trying to do everything. We're trying to be perfect parents. We're trying to be perfect professionals. We're trying to be perfect partners. Of course, we're going to fail at one of those things, if not more. And you can't guilt yourself into growth. That's what we have to understand. You can't guilt yourself into achieving your goals. We don't respond to guilt or blame or shame. When was the last time someone shamed you into becoming better? It doesn't work that way. We become better because someone believes in us. We become better because we believe there's an opportunity. We become better because we feel that someone supports us and loves us no matter what. That's what inspires humans to become better. Or the opposite, where there's lots of pain and lots of loss and lots of stress as well, can do that. But there has to be grace in both.
That's perfect segue to this next question, which is how to deal with the grief of a lost soulmate and how to live life after loss. I'm really struggling. And someone else asked the best approach to dealing with grief.
Katie, I was going to say you're the person to answer that, not me. You know, from what we were speaking about before, I mean, you're the only person who can genuinely answer that from an untheoretical point of view.
We were talking earlier, by the way, that today is the 26th anniversary of my husband's death, which is so hard to fathom. And it's always a sad day for me.
Of course.
Gosh, you know, it's different for every person and each circumstance is different. I think for me, you know, I had two small children who were 6 and 2 when their dad died. And I think for me, I never thought that Jay, my husband, would want to impact their lives in a negative way, the fact that he died. And so I think I wanted their lives to be full of joy. And I also think I wanted to have joy in my life. And as hard as losing someone is, I think the challenge is to make sure that that death doesn't pull so many mm-hmm. other people down with it. And I think I came to terms with this idea that we're all terminal. My dad used to say, no man knows his time or place. Life is so fragile. And that you just have to make the most of whatever time you have. And that doesn't mean not mourning the loss of someone you love, not missing that person terribly. But I think it just means trying to move forward with a life of purpose and joy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard to be prescriptive with questions like this mm-hmm. because everyone, we're all so different and mm-hmm. our relationships are different and we contain multitudes, as Walt Whitman said. Mm-hmm. So I hate to really give advice, but mm-hmm. I do believe in almost every case that it gets better with time. People say it's like carrying a big, heavy stone in your pocket. Mm-hmm. It's always there, but it just doesn't feel as heavy after
mm-hmm.
a while.
Mm-hmm.
But what advice would you give? I mean, I know you must talk to a lot of people as an observer of humanity. What advice would you give those people? I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I don't think we can be prescriptive or, you know, especially in this kind of situation. And I haven't lost a soulmate, so I can only define it. I can only express, like you did, your own experience. And during the pandemic, I lost two people who were very close to me. One was my spiritual mentor who died of stage 4 brain cancer.
So
I couldn't go back to his funeral. And then another friend who was my closest friend when I was a monk, he was still a monk when he died, and he died of colon cancer.
My husband died of.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And so at the same time. So my monk friend was around my age in his 30s and my spiritual mentor was in his 60s. And I can honestly say that I miss them both deeply every day for different reasons. But I let them live on in my life by living as the person they both wanted me to be and by sharing the wisdom they shared with me with others. And so I find that, to me, they're still living with me in their presence and spirit and energy.
It's so unfair, though, isn't it? I mean, I think that's what upsets me the most, that these things are so random. Like, why did your friend who was a monk in his 30s get diagnosed with colon cancer? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so random. What upsets me so much is what these people miss out on. It mm-hmm. makes me feel so terrible that my husband didn't get to walk our daughter down the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't experience becoming a grandfather. It's just so sad to me.
Yeah. And that's why the only thing we can do is experience it on behalf of them and more deeply for them as well. And maybe we would not have experienced these things as deeply if we hadn't had that experience with them. That's all we can do. You know, that's all that we're left with. I find that often these things can be, sometimes when you haven't had that perspective, you may not even approach these moments with that much depth and that much clarity and that much presence, because these moments force you to do that. And I think doing things on behalf of those people is still a beautiful spiritual practice. And, you know, I went on a world tour last year and my London show was dedicated to my spiritual mentor who lived in London. And you know, when I was saying it on stage at the end of the show, I was about to break down after, like, you know, being on stage and performing and everything else. But, you know, I felt like I knew he'd be happy and he was getting to experience it in some way, even when he wasn't physically there.
I was going to ask you, do you believe in life after death?
Yeah, the Eastern perspective is quite clear on reincarnation, which is a fascinating concept.
You believe in reincarnation?
I do.
I want to come back as a cat.
That's possible. That's very, very possible. I read a really beautiful book called Old Souls many years ago by Ian Stevenson, and he documents many different experiences and interactions with reincarnation, past lives, and it's really spectacular. If anyone's curious to hear about it from a more research-based perspective as opposed to a spiritual perspective, that book, Old Souls by Dr. Ian Stevenson, is really remarkable.
I'd like to check that out.
Yeah.
Last question, I promise. You have to go, I have to go. But it's been so fun. By the way, I think I see why you're such an effective podcaster, because suddenly I'm talking about all these intensely personal things with you, Jay Shetty.
I'm glad.
I think it's your voice or your accent or there's something.
Well, my voice is usually quite different when it's my podcast, but you brought this very sober version of me today.
I don't think it's sober. Okay. I think it's much gentle and calm.
Well, you brought that more of me today.
I don't usually have that effect on people.
You had that effect on me today.
What is the best advice you've ever gotten?
Wow. I'm going to share one with you that I haven't shared before, because I answered this recently and we had a clip that went viral with me sharing the advice that I did.
We don't want this to go viral.
I won't say, well, I can say the same thing.
No, you don't have to. Please mix it up, Jay.
I said something on that and it was... No, I'll say it because it is the best advice. It's honestly the best advice I've ever received. So it's from my spiritual mentor that I just spoke about. I remember going to him. I'd left the monastery and I went to him and I said, I have so many ideas of things I want to do to help people, but I have no idea where to start. I don't know what's going to work. I don't know what's going to make an impact. I don't know what's going to matter. And he said to me, open every door possible and then observe which doors close and which doors stay open and keep walking through the ones that stay open, because those are the doors that were meant for you. And I think it's the best advice I've ever received, because I'm only here today sitting with you and talking about all of this because I've just tried, and I still do, try to open every door possible in order for me to live my purpose. I've had so many doors close on me. I've just kept walking through the ones that remain open because I believe those are the right doors. And so anyone out there who's struggling to find direction or what's the right path or what's the right choice, to be honest, no one knows. All you can do is try everything and see what remains open, because what remains open is your path, not what you hope will be. And so, yeah, that's the best advice I've ever received.
Well, this was such a fun conversation and fascinating and deep.
It was very deep.
Yeah. So thank you, Jay. This was really lovely. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I'm so grateful, honestly. And it was wonderful to spend this time with you, genuinely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you have a question for me, a subject you want us to cover, or you want to share your thoughts about how you navigate this crazy world, reach out. You can leave a short message at 609-512-5505, or you can send me a DM on Instagram. I would love to hear from you. Next Question is a production of iHeartMedia and Katie Couric Media. The executive producers are me, Katie Couric, and Courtney Litz. Our supervising producer is Ryan Marks, and our producers are Adriana Fazio and Meredith Barnes. Julian Weller composed our theme music. For more information about today's episode or to sign up for my newsletter, Wake Up Call, go to the description in the podcast app or visit us at katiecouric.com. You can also find me on Instagram and all my social media channels. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring?
but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.